from Indiana to Alabama, South Dakota to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, is global warming actually a good thing? Gregory Wrightstone makes the case in his new book, A Very Convenient Warming: How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. A ruling by the Colorado Supreme Court blocking Donald Trump from the Republican primary ballot has roiled the presidential race. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with a real story. While many states are enjoying a budget surplus, California is racking up a huge budget deficit. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Stephen Greenhut of the R Street Institute. And Congress may be in gridlock, but at the state level, there was much policy progress in 2023. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has details on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. If you listen to environmental extremists, you'd think Armageddon is at hand over the world's changing climate. But in his new book, A Very Convenient Warming, author Gregory Wrightstone argues we are actually in one of the cooler periods of world history, and the current warming trend is a good thing. He is here to explain. Greg, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Greg, the CO2 Coalition has put out an interesting chart. And before we get to the specifics of the book, A Very Convenient Warming, let's talk a little bit about Christmas. It is, of course, the Christmas holiday. Are our holidays getting warmer as we have more CO2 in the atmosphere?
Yeah, I thought I'd make a preemptive strike on what's sure to be something published in the media about this being the hottest Christmas ever, or decades, or the last decade's been the warmest Christmas ever. So I decided to take a look at Christmas temperatures in the lower 48 of the United States, or actually I had a research associate do that for me. He looked at the United States Historical Climatology Network, which is somewhat of the gold standard. It's run by the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. So this is all official government records. And we looked at the average maximum temperature for the lower 48. Now, bear in mind, maximum temperatures would be the daytime temperatures nearly always. And we took a look at that going back to 1895, and it's all over the place, up and down, up and down. But the overall trend is flat. It's slightly declining. We put the trend line to it, but barely. But it's not increasing is what we're being told. It was really something to see that. In that chart, I compared carbon dioxide, atmospheric carbon dioxide, and all the while, carbon dioxide has been increasing. But we're being told that carbon dioxide increases are leading to unusual and unprecedented warming, and the actual facts, the science, and the data just don't support that, Loman. It's something to take a look at this actual data. Now, bear in mind, this is average maximum temperature. We also looked at the average mean temperature, and that has increased in the lower 48 by about a degree over the last 100 years. But that's being driven by higher nighttime temperatures. So nighttime temperatures aren't as cold, and that's actually driving the warming that we see on the average. And so higher nighttime temperatures are a good thing. They're very good. It doesn't get nearly as cold now as what it did 100 years ago. And why is that so good? Well, it leads to longer growing seasons. Since 1900, the growing season in the United States has lengthened by 2 weeks. So farmers, agricultural producers, if you have an orchard, an apple orchard, there are many of those across Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, all across the country. What do they fear most? Late spring frost, killing frost. Well, now with higher nighttime temperatures, those killing frosts end earlier in the spring and arrive later in the fall. And so because of that, our agricultural production partly is due to this warming temperature of nighttime temperatures. And we should celebrate that.
It's interesting, in your book, A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. Greg, of course, we have all these climate alarmists running around out there. Oh, we're going to cook, the oceans are going to rise, we're all going to die from heat. But what you're pointing out in the book, because you go back more than 40 or 50 years, you go back literally thousands of years, we may be in a warming trend, but we're actually still somewhat in a cooler period, correct?
Yes, we are. If we look in the really big picture of millions of years, we're in some of the coldest temperatures ever. Thankfully, we're in the middle of an ice age. We've been in this ice age for about 3 or 4 million years. We happen to be in a warm period. Right now, it's called an interglacial warming, thankfully. If we weren't, we would have the glacial advance we saw from 20,000 years ago with Boston under 1,000 or more feet of ice and nearly all of Canada under hundreds and thousands of feet of ice. That would not be a good thing. And that's coming at some point in the future. So we should celebrate this interglacial warming we're seeing. Also, Lohmann in the book, which you've seen, is a strong relationship. I have a whole section on the strong relationship between human history and climate history. And we find that these warming periods that we're in, like we are today, have historically been hugely beneficial to humanity, with bountiful food production. Great empires and civilizations arose. And then each time it got cold, the intervening cold periods that went by the names of like the Greek Dark Ages, the Dark Ages, or the Little Ice Age, each one of those cold periods were just horrific to mankind. Each one of those was associated with crop failure, famine, pestilence, and mass depopulation. So what history tells us is we should fear the cold and welcome the warmth. Those that disagree, like Michael Mann, John Kerry, Greta Thunberg, they call me a science denier, but no, I grasp onto the science. We should label them history deniers, which is what they are, because they're denying that history tells us that warming is good and cold is bad.
In your book, you talk more about the relationship of the Pacific Ocean and the warming and cooling trends there as having a bigger impact on overall climate change than CO2 emissions. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, right now we're in what's called an El Nino event. These occur periodically. Each of the past big El Nino events in 1998, 2016, and the one we're in right now, we saw a big bump in temperature during this. It's Pacific Ocean event. The counterpart is called La Niña, which drives cooling or flat temperatures. So we see these big events. It was interesting. There was another big event that coincided with the eruption of Pinatubo, Mount Pinatubo, in the Philippines. And actually, that was the one El Niño that didn't heat up as much, and that's because Mount Pinatubo, and there was another huge volcano at the same time, put up so much aerosols into the stratosphere that it blocked the sun. And these big volcanoes, like, they can have a cooling effect on Earth's atmosphere for 4 and 5 years, which is what we saw after Pinatubo.
We have been talking with Gregory Wrightstone, who is author of the new book, A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. Greg is executive director of the CO2 Coalition. And Greg, let's end by having you tell us a bit about the CO2 Coalition. And the book's not quite available on Amazon yet, but they can get it. Tell us how that can happen.
It's available at direct sales through the website, which is convenientwarming.com, convenientwarming.com. We'll have it up on Amazon either mid-January, mid-February, but go get it now. So convenientwarming.com. The CO2 Coalition is the premier scientific organization that's fighting back against climate alarmism. We've got more than 150 of the top scientists in the world. And so we're the tip of the spear when it comes to pushing back against climate alarmism. And that's co2coalition.org.
Gregory Wrightstone, author of A Very Convenient Warming. Greg, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. There's been some major developments out among the states relative to the 2024 presidential election, which is looming right ahead of us now. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Lohmann. Thanks for having me.
Bit of a bombshell this past week, Scott, out of Colorado, where the state Supreme Court issued a ruling that could impact the presidential race. Want to fill us in on the details?
So what you basically have here are the Colorado Supreme Court issuing a ruling that President Trump should not be on the ballot in Colorado. There's obviously going to be an appeals process that unfolds. But what they did was they cited the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, and in particular, they cited the third paragraph, which talks about not being eligible to run for president if you have incited an insurrection against your country. And it's just more of the same that we see, I think, from these radical leftists that are trying to do everything they can to stop Donald Trump from being the next president of the United States. I'm not hearing a lot of talk out there about all the great things that Joe Biden is doing. And instead, it's like what I think we saw in 2020 and even 2016 to an extent, where folks think that Donald Trump is a threat to everything that they want to see accomplished at the White House. And he's obviously been an unconventional president when it comes to his agenda and his personality. And I think that the left is just terrified of that. So what we saw in Colorado, I think, is just the beginning of an additional witch hunt, an additional sort of Hail Mary from the left to try to keep Donald Trump off the ballot in the 2024 election.
Well, Scott, as we look at that ruling, which likely will end up now before the U.S. Supreme Court, which will have the final say in all these things, of course, every time the left does something like this, we look back at all the indictments that unfolded over the past year against Donald Trump. It seems like every time they do this, all they do is make him more popular and make his base even more determined to win the election.
Yeah, and you know, I think the Colorado Republicans, Dave Williams is their chairman. He put out a statement earlier this week that said, hey, if they're going to try to keep Donald Trump off the ballot, what I'm going to do is I'm going to completely end the primary process and we're going to change to a caucus. And good luck keeping him out of the caucus is basically what Dave has said there. So I think that that's pretty interesting. Obviously, these indictments, since they've been pouring in really in the early months of 2023, I think that they've strengthened the resolve of the Trump voter. And what a lot of people just don't really understand, they're having a hard time, I think, getting their brain wrapped around it, is Donald Trump is enthusiastically loved by far too many people for you to be able to stop him. And when people see him being attacked, when they see him being treated unfairly, as it pertains to the electoral process and the presidency, I think that these folks just double down their support for him. And the historic indictments being out there, a lot of people said, oh, you know, these indictments, it's going to drag him so far down. All it did was strengthen the MAGA America First movement that Donald Trump embraces. And so I think that it's just something for everybody to kind of keep in mind. Donald Trump is winning all these important battleground states right now when you look at the polling, and Joe Biden is in a heap of trouble.
Before we get to the potential Trump-Biden rematch here, though, Scott, we have to go through the Republican nomination process. As we look forward here to the month of January, I want to just bring our listeners up to date on what that calendar looks like. What are the early states, and where will the Republican nomination process begin to unfold?
Well, things get kicked off with Iowa. The Iowa caucuses for Republicans are on January 15th. And just 8 days later, we have the first in the nation presidential primary in New Hampshire on January 23rd. So as everybody out there is, you know, getting ready for Christmas and getting excited for unwrapping gifts, there's a lot of excitement in those presidential races in the early states like Iowa and New Hampshire. And so with Iowa and New Hampshire being the only races in January, we're going to be going into February, where the Democrats have South Carolina on February 3rd, Republicans have South Carolina on February 24th, Nevada is going to be February 6th for the Democrats and February 8th for the Republicans and their caucus. The bottom line is here, we've got bunch of states that are about to get underway. We know that the spending has been heavy. You're seeing President Trump and Ron DeSantis and and Ramaswamy and Nikki Haley and others still barnstorming throughout Iowa and New Hampshire. Just wait until we get a couple weeks ahead. I think that it's going to be front and center on all those voters' minds, and we're going to have even a better picture of what those races look like. Obviously, President Trump has big leads right now within Iowa and New Hampshire, and Nikki Haley has been surging in the New Hampshire presidential primary. I know that Ron DeSantis and Ramaswamy are hoping still to at least have a second-place finish in those states. So I know that their campaigns will say, well, we want to win it, but you know, Trump's lead is pretty much insurmountable right now.
We will continue to keep an eye on that as we look forward to the actual voting getting underway after a long warm-up season here. We have been, as usual, talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We're united in this idea of economic liberty, freedom, and opportunity. If you want to join Club for Growth for free, you can do so at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, Merry Christmas to everyone at the Club for Growth.
Merry Christmas.
California is facing a huge budget deficit, and that may actually be good, as Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns from Stephen Greenhut of the R Street Institute.
The state of California could be facing a $68 billion budget deficit next year. That's a deficit that's larger, quite a bit larger, than the entire general fund budget in the state of Florida, by the way. And normally, when states face big budget deficits, I mean, that's not something to celebrate. But, as my guest today will argue, California facing a big budget deficit might actually be kind of a good thing. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest this week is Steve Greenhut. He is at the R Street Institute, the Western Regional Director for the R Street Institute. He's also a columnist at the Orange County Register and a longtime friend of mine. Steve, thanks for taking some time and joining us here on the show.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
So California's got a big budget deficit. I think actually before we talk about the huge budget deficit they've got right now, we should talk a little bit about the huge budget surplus that the state had just a year ago. What happened?
Yeah, and 18 months ago, we had a $97.5 billion surplus. So Governor Gavin Newsom, I mean, and the legislators, they were beside themselves with glee. They could just spend money. And guess what they did? They spent money. And mostly on social programs. They put a little bit of money aside in the rainy day fund and things like that. But mostly they just went on a spending spree. Most of people who observers, especially of the libertarian bent, were warning them to, at the very least, we can fix some of the problems, some of the fundamental infrastructure problems. You have that much extra money. You could make a real dent, and not to mention sending more money back to taxpayers. I mean, they sent a little bit back, but they had an unprecedented opportunity, but of course they punted on that. And then the next year we had a budget deficit that at one point hit like $31.5 billion. And then Newsom and the legislature basically kicked the can down the road. They reduced some of the spending that they had already allocated, and they shifted funds around, and they pretty much didn't cut anything. And in fact, the governor was very proud of the fact that they continued to make historic investments, blah, blah, blah. And basically, they were expecting the economy to come roaring back, even though most of the analysts in the Capitol were saying that's pretty much a pipe dream. And now we have a $68 billion deficit, and now they're going to have to actually make some hard choices.
Yeah, as a libertarian and as somebody who spent some time in state capitals, I mean, I am always a little bit, you know, you're worried about those big surpluses because you do see like lawmakers and staffers' eyes just light up, and it's all excitement about how we get to spend all this extra money that we didn't think we'd have. On the flip side, when you have that deficit now, it does require, since states are at least nominally required to balance their budgets, it does force you to make some difficult choices. Any idea what California might do to close that deficit this year? Is it still too far out to really tell?
Yeah, I haven't seen any proposals yet. I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do. I'm sure they'll use the variety of gimmicks, but they're going to have to cut spending somewhere. And unfortunately, our state seems to, They seem to measure success by how much they spend rather than how much they get in return. So we've had unprecedented increases in transit funding, and transit ridership is plummeting. We have huge increases in education funding, and like 40% or more is by state initiative has to go to public schools, and yet the test scores, especially after COVID, are abysmal. So I think once we get back after the new year, we'll see what they have in mind. But they're going to have to do something this time. You know, they could trim some of the money from this whole California climate commitment, which it's a multi-year program, but it's like $54 billion. I mean, that's a lot of money. And they're going to have to trim agencies and stop with all the new spending.
We're talking with Stephen Greenhut. He is the Western Regional Director for the R Street Institute and a columnist at the Orange County Register, talking about California's budget situation. Steve, just a minute or so left here, but I want to kind of pull back and go big picture here and ask you to, you know, respond to this for me. California, as you mentioned, how dependent the state is on capital gains taxes, how dependent the state is on high income earners for its tax revenue. And a lot of those people seem to be leaving. Is there a sense that California, you can't just raise taxes to close this deficit at this point, right? Is there a sense that this will require some like philosophical reorientation? I'm probably being way overly optimistic in even suggesting that, but some sort of you know reorientation of the way the state thinks about its budget.
Yeah, that's what a normal, decently run state would do. Instead, I think I'm sure we're gonna see a bunch of proposals for tax and fee increases. In fact, even when we had the surplus, there were a bunch of proposals for tax increases. So they have an insatiable appetite for spending. But that, the point you make is a good one. The state keeps chasing its high income earners, of whom they're totally dependent on for the budget. They keep chasing them to other states.
As a general rule, I don't really like the idea that, well, if things get bad enough, then they'll get better. It's not like people will just wake up one day and be libertarian because things got so bad. Although, I mean, I don't know. Maybe Argentina makes a case for that now. Maybe California is also trending in that same direction. So I don't like that idea, but I guess we're going to test it out, at least in California. We might. That's all the time we have for today, unfortunately. Steve, thanks for taking some time with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And again, that's Steve Greenhut. He's the Western Regional Director for the R Street Institute and a columnist at the Orange County Register. Check out his work at ocregister.com. Check out his columns at reason.com as well. We republish him every week. And of course, click over to reason.com for everything else we're working on. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Much progress was made in 2023 as many states enacted pro-taxpayer reforms and expanded education freedom. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council details the wins on this American Radio Journal commentary.
As 2023 comes to a close, it's important to take a few minutes to celebrate the important free market policy wins that happened across the nation at the state level in 2023. While they unfortunately don't receive the kind of media attention that federal issues generally do, these state policy wins are arguably much more meaningful for hardworking American taxpayers. Starting with the continuation of the historic tax cut movement, which began in 2021, 11 states cut income tax rates in 2023. The year began with Kentucky making a rate reduction in January and setting itself on the path to personal income tax elimination should revenue triggers be met. Notably, even deep blue Connecticut enacted personal income tax cuts this year, providing the tax cut movement can and should be a bipartisan cause. Other states cutting taxes include West Virginia, Montana, Utah, Arkansas, North Dakota, Indiana, Nebraska, Ohio, and North Carolina. The cuts seen in 22 states since the start of this tax cut movement in 2021 have been the product of surpluses created by prudent state fiscal practices and unprecedented levels of tax revenues. However, this doesn't prevent the budgetary doomsdayers from crying foul when lawmakers begin to discuss how to return overcollected tax dollars into the hardworking taxpayer. One common doomsdayer refrain is that tax cuts will harm the children, as the money used for cuts will be taken from education spending, as the argument goes. However, this completely ignores the fact that several states, such as North Carolina, have simultaneously increased teacher pay and cut taxes. North Carolina is just one of numerous policy examples of how tax cuts lead to enhanced economic conditions, more prosperity for all, and many times far more revenue generation than originally projected. As celebration-worthy as historic 2023 tax cuts are, 2023 is likely better described as the year of education freedom and parental rights in education, as an incredible 8 additional states enacted education freedom accounts that allow parents to choose the educational options that are best meet the needs of their individual children. Since the COVID-19 pandemic, the education freedom movement has picked up steam. The full switch to school choice started in West Virginia back in 2021 and continued with Arizona in 2022 before the windfall of wins for families and children this year. Several states also took steps to protect retiree benefits this year, most notably in North Dakota, led by House Majority Leader Mike LaFleur. Recognized the threat of unfunded pension liabilities to pension plan beneficiaries and taxpayers and made the switch to their pension plans from defined benefit to defined contribution 401k type systems to provide financial responsibility as well as flexibility for young workers. Beyond the defined contribution switch, several states took steps to keep politics out of pension investing. Environmental social governance, so-called ESG, investing and similar politically motivated strategies threaten to drive unfunded liabilities even higher in state pension systems as investors using this strategy are no longer concerned in many cases with what is financially best for the plans. The ALEC model policy, State Government Employee Retirement Protection Act, keeps politics out of pensions by requiring that money managers, fiduciaries, make money management and proxy vote decisions with the sole financial interest of the planned and retirees in mind, known as the sole interest rule. Arkansas, led by Representative Mindy McElinden and Senator Josh Bryant, and Montana, led by Representative Terry Moore and Senator Tom McGillivray, used the ALEC model as a starting point from which to put the sole interest rule into law in those states, setting the gold standard for protecting public sector retirees with meaningful fiduciary rules. In addition to these two states, at least 6 others have passed laws that mirror the ALEC model, and many more have taken steps to protect their pension systems from these politically based investments. 2023 has been an incredible year for free market policy wins across the nation and the hardworking taxpayers who will ultimately benefit from them. The momentum is in stark contrast to the seemingly permanent gridlock that has besieged our federal government in Washington, D.C. In this regard, the last few years at ALEC incredibly excited for 2024. In addition to the year ahead, we've laid out our essential policy solutions for 2024 in a new publication. In it, we outline the best policy solutions from our policy task forces that are designed to tackle the most prescient issues Americans are facing, and that we believe best promote free markets, limited government, and federalism. For more information and to download your free copy of our 2024 ALEC Essential Policy Solutions for States, visit alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WRSKLP in Newton, New Jersey, WERG-FM in Erie, Pennsylvania, along with KFBX-AM in Fairbanks, Alaska. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.